yet we have every reason to believe that these factors determine his character. Our system of justice should reflect an understanding that any of us could have been dealt a very different hand in life. In fact, it seems immoral not to recognize just how much luck is involved in morality itself. To see how fully our moral intuitions must shift, consider what would happen if we discovered a cure for human evil. Imagine that every relevant change in the human brain can now be made cheaply, painlessly, and safely. In fact, the cure could be put directly into the food supply, like vitamin D. Evil would become nothing more than a nutritional deficiency. If we imagine that a cure for evil exists, we can see that our retributive impulse is morally flawed. Consider, for instance, the prospect of withholding the cure for evil from a murderer as part of his punishment. Would this make any sense at all? What could it possibly mean to say that a person deserves to have this treatment withheld? What if the treatment was available prior to his crime? Would he still be responsible for his actions? It seems far more likely that those who'd been aware of his case would be indicted for negligence. Would it make any sense to deny surgery to the man in Case 5 as a punishment if we knew that his brain tumor was the actual cause of his violence? Of course not. The implications of this seem inescapable. The urge for retribution depends upon our not seeing the underlying causes of human behavior. Despite our attachment to the notion of free will, most of us know that disorders of the brain can trump the best intentions of the mind. This shift in understanding represents progress toward a deeper, more consistent, and more compassionate view of our common humanity. And we should note that it is progress away from religious metaphysics. Few concepts have offered greater scope for human cruelty than the idea of an immortal soul that stands independent of all material influences, ranging from genes to economic systems. Within a religious framework, a belief in free will supports the notion of sin, which seems to justify not only harsh punishment in this life, but eternal punishment in the next. And yet, ironically, one of the fears attending our progress in science is that a more complete understanding of ourselves will dehumanize us. Viewing human beings as natural phenomena need not damage our system of criminal justice. If we could incarcerate earthquakes and hurricanes for their crimes, we would build prisons for them as well. We fight emerging epidemics, and even the occasional wild animal, without attributing free will to them. Clearly, we can respond intelligently to the threat posed by dangerous people without lying to ourselves about the ultimate origins of human behavior. We will still need a criminal justice system that attempts to accurately assess guilt and innocence, along with the future risks that the guilty pose to society. But the logic of punishing people will come undone, unless we find that punishment is an essential component of deterrence or rehabilitation. It must be admitted, however, that the issue of retribution is a tricky one. In a fascinating article in The New Yorker, Jared Diamond writes of the high price we sometimes pay when our desire for vengeance goes unfulfilled. He compares the experiences of two people, his friend Daniel, a New Guinea Highlander who avenged the death of a paternal uncle, and his late father-in-law, who had the opportunity to kill the man who murdered his entire family during the Holocaust, but opted instead to turn him over to the police. After spending only a year in jail, the killer was released. The consequences of taking revenge in the first case and foregoing it in the second could not have been starker. While there is much to be said against the vendetta culture of the New Guinea Highlands, Daniel's revenge brought him exquisite relief, whereas Diamond's father-in-law spent the last 60 years of his life, quote, tormented by regret and guilt. Clearly, vengeance answers to a powerful psychological need in many of us. We are deeply disposed to perceive people as the authors of their actions, to hold them responsible for the wrongs they do us, and to feel that these transgressions must be punished. Often, the only punishment that seems appropriate is for the perpetrator of a crime to suffer or forfeit his life. It remains to be seen how a scientifically informed system of justice might steward these impulses. Clearly, a full account of the causes of human behavior should attenuate our natural response to injustice, at least to some degree. I doubt, for instance, that Diamond's father-in-law would have suffered the same anguish if his family had been trampled by an elephant or laid low by cholera. We can also assume that his regret would have been significantly eased if he had learned that his family's killer had lived a flawlessly moral life until a virus had begun ravaging his medial prefrontal cortex. However, it may be that a sham form of retribution would still be moral, or even necessary, if it led people to behave better than they otherwise would. whether it is useful to emphasize the punishment of certain criminals, rather than their containment or rehabilitation, is a question for social and psychological science. But it seems clear that a desire for retribution, arising from the idea that each person is the free author of his thoughts and actions, rests on a cognitive and emotional illusion, and perpetuates a moral one. One way of viewing the connection between free will and moral responsibility is to note that we generally attribute these qualities to people only with respect to actions that punishment might deter. I cannot hold you responsible for behaviors that you could not possibly control. If we made sneezing illegal, for instance, some number of people would break the law no matter how grave the consequences. A behavior like kidnapping, however, seems to require conscious deliberation and sustained effort at every turn. Hence, it should admit of deterrence. If the threat of punishment could cause you to stop doing what you're doing, your behavior falls squarely within the conventional notions of free will and moral responsibility. It may be true that strict punishment, rather than mere containment or rehabilitation, is necessary to prevent certain crimes. But punishing people purely for pragmatic reasons would be very different from the approach we currently take. Of course, if punishing bacteria and viruses would prevent the emergence of pandemic diseases, we would mete out justice to them as well. A wide variety of human behaviors can be modified by punishments and incentives, and attributing responsibility to people in these contexts is quite natural. It may even be unavoidable as a matter of convention. As the psychologist Daniel Wegner points out, the idea of free will can be a tool for understanding human behavior. To say that someone freely chose to squander his life savings at the poker table is to say that he had every opportunity to do otherwise, and that nothing about what he did was inadvertent. He played poker not by accident or while in the grip of a delusion, but because he wanted to, intended to, and decided to, moment after moment. For most purposes, it makes sense to ignore the deep causes of desires and intentions, genes, synaptic potentials, etc., and focus instead on the conventional outlines of the person. We do this when thinking about our own choices and behaviors, because it's the easiest way to organize our thoughts and actions. Why did I order beer instead of wine? Because I prefer beer. Why do I prefer it? I don't know, but I generally have no need to ask. Knowing that I like beer more than wine is all I need to know to function in a restaurant. Whatever the reason, I prefer one taste to the other. Is there freedom in this? None whatsoever. Would I magically reclaim my freedom if I decided to spite my preference and order wine instead? No, because the roots of this intention would be as obscure as the preference itself. Politics. For better or worse, dispelling the illusion of free will has political implications, because liberals and conservatives are not equally enthralled to it. Liberals tend to understand that a person can be lucky or unlucky in all matters relevant to his success. Conservatives, however, often make a religious fetish of individualism. Many seem to have absolutely no awareness of how fortunate one must be to succeed at anything in life, no matter how hard one works. One must be lucky to be able to work. One must be lucky to be intelligent, physically healthy, and not be bankrupted in middle age by the illness of a spouse. Consider the biography of any self-made man, and you will find that his success was entirely dependent upon background conditions that he did not make, and of which he was merely the beneficiary. There is not a person on earth who chose his genome, or the country of his birth, or the political and economic conditions that prevailed at moments crucial to his progress. And yet, living in America, one gets the distinct sense that if certain conservatives were asked why they weren't born with club feet or orphaned before the age of 5, they would not hesitate to take credit for these accomplishments. Even if you have struggled to make the most of what nature gave you, you must still admit that your ability and inclination to struggle is part of your inheritance. How much credit does a person deserve for not being lazy? None at all. Laziness, like diligence, is a neurological condition. Of course, conservatives are right to think that we must encourage people to work to the best of their abilities and discourage free riders wherever we can. And it is wise to hold people responsible for their actions when doing so influences their behavior and brings benefit to society. But this does not mean that we must be taken in by the illusion of free will. We need only acknowledge that efforts matter and that people can change. We do not change ourselves precisely because we only have ourselves with which to do the changing. But we continually influence, and are influenced by, the world around us and the world within us. It may seem paradoxical to hold people responsible for what happens in their corner of the universe, but once we break the spell of free will, we can do this precisely to the degree that it is useful. Where people can change, we can demand that they do so. Where change is impossible or unresponsive to demands, we can chart some other course. In improving ourselves and society, we are working directly with the forces of nature, for there is nothing but nature itself to work with. Conclusion. It is generally argued that our experience of free will presents a compelling mystery. On the one hand, we can't make sense of it in scientific terms. On the other, we feel that we are the authors of our own thoughts and actions. However, I think this mystery is itself a symptom of our confusion. It is not that free will is simply an illusion. Our experience is not merely delivering a distorted view of reality. Rather, we are mistaken about our experience. Not only are we not as free as we think we are, we do not feel as free as we think we do. Our sense of our own freedom results from our not paying close attention to what it is like to be us. The moment we pay attention, it is possible to see that free will is nowhere to be found, and our experience is perfectly compatible with this truth. Thoughts and intentions simply arise in the mind. What else could they do? The truth about us is stranger than many suppose. The illusion of free will is itself an illusion. The problem is not merely that free will makes no sense objectively, that is, when our thoughts and actions are viewed from a third-person point of view. It makes no sense subjectively either. It is quite possible to notice this through introspection. In fact, I will now perform an experiment in free will for all to see. I will now say anything I want for the rest of this audiobook. Whatever I say will, of course, be something I choose to say. No one is compelling me to do this. No one has assigned me a topic or demanded that I use certain words. I can be ungrammatical if I pleased. And if I want to put a rabbit in this sentence, I am free to do so. But paying attention to my stream of consciousness reveals that this notion of freedom does not reach very deep. Where did this rabbit come from? Why didn't I put an elephant in that sentence? I do not know. Am I free to change rabbit to elephant? Of course. But if I did this, how could I explain it? It is impossible for me to know the cause of either choice. Either is compatible with my being compelled by the laws of nature, or buffeted by the winds of chance. But neither looks or feels like freedom. Rabbit or elephant? Am I free to decide that elephant is the better word when I just do not feel that it is the better word? Am I free to change my mind? Of course not. It can only change me. And what brings my deliberations on these matters to a close? This book must end sometime, and now I want to get something to eat. Am I free to resist this feeling? Well, yes, in the sense that no one's going to force me at gunpoint to eat, but I'm hungry. Can I resist this feeling a moment longer? Yes, of course, and for an indeterminate number of moments thereafter. But I don't know why I make the effort in this instance and not in others. And why do my efforts cease precisely when they do? Now I feel it really is time for me to leave. I'm hungry, yes, but it also seems I've made my point. In fact, I can't think of anything else to say on the subject. And where is the freedom in that?
Free Will was written and read by Sam Harris. It was recorded at Margarita Mix in Santa Monica by Mike Merzen and Sean Melia. Editing and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Christina Zarafanidis. Free Will was produced and directed by Tara Thomas. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Free Will is available in hardcover from Free Press. Other Sam Harris titles from Simon & Schuster Audio, The Moral Landscape, read by the author, and Letter to a Christian Nation, read by Jordan Bridges.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.